6. Singing Sands. A year after my visit to St. Paul's Cathedral, I travelled to Kelso Dunes in the Mojave Desert, California, with sound recordist Diane Hope, in the hope of hearing a sand dune sing. Kelso is one of about 40 documented sites where this happens. The English naturalist Charles Darwin recounts tales of the El Bramador Hill in Chile, which was called the Roarer or Bellower by locals. Ancient Chinese writings describe festivities at the Mingxia sand dunes. It is customary on the Tuan Wu Day, the dragon festival on the 5th of the 5th moon, for men and women to rush down in a body, which causes the sand to give forth a loud rumbling sound like thunder. A sand avalanche starts the dune singing. The slope has to be steep, and the sand has to be very dry. But dry sand is by definition the loosest, which meant my feet struggled to find purchase on Kelso's surface. I had prepared for the extreme temperatures of the summer desert, but I had not realized that searching for musical dunes was going to be an aerobic workout. I wanted to gasp for air as I struggled up the dune, yet I had to hold my breath so as not to ruin the audio recordings. As I trudged up the sandy slope, my feet made a burping noise in the sand. It reminded me of the first part of Marco Polo's description. He wrote that dunes, at times, fill the air with the sounds of all kinds of musical instruments, and also of drums and the clash of arms. I was getting nothing dramatic like drums, but I was creating something musical. Each labored footstep created a single honk, like a badly played tuba. Toward the top of the slope, I got so tired that I resorted to scrambling up on all fours, producing a comical brass quartet. While the burping was entertaining, I was frustrated because the dunes were not in full voice. What I had traveled to hear was a sustained boom that supposedly reaches 110 decibels, resembling the loudness of a rock group audible up to a mile away. It was getting toward late morning. The wind was making recording difficult and the heat was becoming unbearable, so we retreated down the dune to try again the next day. Back at the campsite, I listened to a recording of my phone interview with Natalie Vrindt from Cambridge University, who had studied the singing sands for her doctorate. I was looking for hints of how to find the best place on the dunes. Worryingly, in the middle, Natalie mentioned that a friend had visited Kelso in recent times and had been disappointed by the sound. I also reviewed key scientific papers. I hoped that, by understanding the physics, I might have a better chance of getting the dunes to properly sing the next day. While scientists agree that burping sand is a necessary ingredient, there is a heated debate about what actually causes the loud booming. Is a deep layer of the dune vibrating like a giant musical instrument? Or are the sand grains locked in a synchronized avalanche? During a proper boom, thousands of sand grains sing in a coordinated choir stretched over many yards across the dune. Waterfalls are similarly made from an extended orchestra, but the instrumentalists are tiny bubbles. The loudest waterfall I ever heard is Dettifoss on the glacial river Jökulsá-Eyjafjöllum in Iceland. It is also the most powerful in Europe. Many years ago, my wife and I cycled there on a bitterly cold and unpleasant morning. The road was more like a track, rough and potholed, and the northerly headwind poured cold air down from the Arctic with such strength that it brought us to a standstill at times. We made tortuous progress, first through winding moorland and then through the Sandur, a desolate landscape of glacial outwash and black volcanic silt where little grows. Leaving the bikes behind, we gingerly walked to the cliff edge overlooking the falls, which are more than 100 meters, 325 feet wide, and 44 meters, 145 feet high. Standing very close to the precipice, a pang of fear swept through my body. With 180 cubic meters, 6,000 cubic feet of water pounding over the edge per second, a slip now would end in certain death. The incessant, thunderous power meant we had to shout to be heard. The noise seemed to cover every frequency at once, from a bass rumble up to a high-pitched hiss. The falls presented an overwhelming and isolating noise, like the sort controversially used by the CIA to achieve sensory deprivation during interrogations. Water might be a simple substance, but it can make a vast range of sounds, from babbling brooks to crashing waves, from torrential rain to the plink of a single drip. Describing Yosemite Falls, the American naturalist John Muir wrote that the water seems to burst forth in irregular spurts from some grand throbbing mountain heart. At the bottom of the fall, it is mostly a hissing, clashing, seething, upwhirling mass. This noble fall has far the richest, as well as the most powerful voice of all the falls of the valley. Its tones varying from the sharp hiss and rustle of the wind in the glossy leaves of the live oak and the soft, sifting, hushing tones of the pines, to the loudest rush and roar of storm winds and thunder among the crags of the summit peaks. For decades, scientists have been interested in how falling water, such as crashing waves, creates sound underwater, because the noise impedes submariners listening for the enemy. But I want to know about what happens above the surface, and fortunately, scientists have now turned their attention to this question. Laurent Galbraith from Heriot Watt University in Scotland has been investigating how to make an impressive sounding fountain or water feature while pumping the minimum amount of water to reduce energy use. In parallel work, Greg Watts and colleagues at Bradford University in England have been investigating water falling onto different rocks and into pools in search of the best sounds for hiding traffic noise. After recording a diverse playlist of water features, they had a panel of listeners judge the pleasantness of each sound. This experiment had to be undertaken in an acoustic laboratory, a room hardly conducive to making aesthetic judgments on outdoor water features. So the researchers built a theatre set within the laboratory. It was a garden balcony, complete with bamboo screens, potted plants, and garden furniture, to get the subjects into the right frame of mind. After the subjects had scored how much they liked each sound, Watts came to the conclusion that the worst noises had a booming quality, reminiscent of water flowing down into drains or utilitarian culverts. The most pleasing sounds sploshed and splashed, having a natural randomness as the water fell onto an uneven surface formed from small boulders. In similar tests, Galbraith found that the gentle babbling of a slow-moving natural stream was the most relaxing of all water sounds tested. The source of the waterfall sounds surprised me at first. A television crew recently filmed what happens in my university's anechoic chamber. A high-speed camera captured a single drop falling into a fish tank of water. A slow-motion video from the top looks pretty. The drop causes a narrow column of water to rise up from the surface, creating ripples. But to understand what is heard, you need to look from the side, just underneath the surface of the water. While the ripples are visually impressive, a single tiny air bubble generates most of the sound. As the bottom of the drop penetrates the surface of the water, a bulging meniscus is created from which a tiny air bubble suddenly breaks away. This bubble of trapped air is only a few millimeters in diameter and so is easy to overlook and difficult to film. It may be small, but the air inside the bubble vibrates, resonates, and creates a plink that travels through the water and into the air. Water falling onto rocks sounds very different because no underwater bubbles can be made, unless a layer of water has built up on the stone. Again, it is easiest to think about what happens when one drop smashes onto a rock and is splattered across the stone. As the falling drop smears itself into a thin layer of water on the stone, it disturbs the air around it, creating the sound. A couple of months after the television crew filmed a single bubble, I got to learn more about aquatic sounds from artist Lee Patterson. We met up in the English Lake District, where Lee described how, in local ponds and watercourses in northern England, he had discovered underwater sounds as rich as tropical rainforests. We chatted about the piece he was going to compose from his recordings in the Lake District. The Laughing Water Dashes Through was going to be a work prompted by the devastating floods that had hit the nearby market town of Cockermouth a few years previously. Lee explained how the work would explore the different forms of energy embodied by water flow and the sound that happens as a byproduct of the water flow. He was recording in a small, enclosed, flooded quarry on the day I visited. With blazingly hot sunshine and the birds singing around us, it was an idyllic spot, provided we stood with our back to an ugly concrete shed. Lee had simple homemade hydrophones, constructed from a sliver of shiny piezoelectric material, which makes electricity when it is deformed by underwater sound waves, embedded in the tops of brightly colored plastic screw caps from pop bottles. He cast these into the water, turned up the amplifier, and passed me the headphones. I heard a malevolent munching and crunching. It was as if an animal was trying to nibble away at my eardrum. The sound came from tadpoles scraping the hydrophones, in the vain hope that there was algae on the bottle caps. The tadpoles were swimming among oxygenating pondweed, and with a careful repositioning of the hydrophones, strange mechanical chirps could be heard, like bacon being deep-fried. These were caused by a fast stream of small bubbles rising up from the pondweed, looking like champagne bubbles rising up in a glass. It turns out that photosynthesizing plants were making the bubble streams. A few days later, I spoke to Helen Chersky from the University of Southampton, who studies how sound is made as bubbles are created. Her research shows that as bubbles form at a small nozzle, sound is created because the bubble initially has a teardrop shape while attached to the nozzle, but when it breaks away into the body of the water, it forms a sphere. This shape change causes the bubble to vibrate, resonating the air inside and creating sound. Helen was skeptical that this is what happens with pondweed, because natural bubbles from photosynthesis form more slowly and therefore probably lack the impulsive kick as they break off. She thought it was more likely that I was hearing the bubbles bumping into each other or into the hydrophones. The waterfall at Dettifoss in Iceland can be explained by scaling up the effects of a single oscillating bubble to consider the vast number of bubbles in the white cascade. Each ball of trapped air is a different size and plinks a note at its own particular frequency. In the cascade, the combination of millions of random plinks creates a vast bubble orchestra, which fizzes and roars. Each waterfall has its own voice. If it tends to have lots of larger bubbles, it'll have a bassy rumble. Smaller bubbles result in more hissing, like the Yosemite Falls described by Muir. Surrounding rocks can further alter the sound. Svartifoss in southern Iceland is only about 20 meters, 65 feet high. It has water cascading from a horseshoe of overhanging cliffs made up of hexagonal basalt columns. The name, meaning Black Fall, comes from the color of the rocks, and on the day I visited, the color was strongly emphasized by the overcast, drizzly weather. However, it is worth an hour's walk even in the rain, because not only do the surrounding rocks make stunning holiday snapshots, but they also amplify the water as it slaps and hisses against them. Another impressive Icelandic waterfall is Seljalandsfoss, where you can go behind the curtain and be surrounded by noise, as the fizzing from the water hitting the pool is reflected from the cliff behind you. The flow of water is not constant, which means the noise splutters. Close your eyes, and you can imagine a small freight train rumbling past overhead. While waterfalls are common, the sound of a tidal bore, a single tall wave that sweeps inland up a narrowing estuary, is much rarer. The bore of Rio Araguari in Brazil is named Pororoco in the language of the native Tupi, which translates as mighty noise. Closer to my home is the Severn bore, near Gloucester in England. Early on a misty September morning, part of a brief Indian summer, forecasters predicted a four-star bore on the heels of a large tide driven by the autumnal equinox. As I wandered along the banks of the river, I saw a few surfers midstream, clutching their boards ready to catch the wave. This must be a good place to watch, I thought. I first stood close to the water's edge, but then realized that the silt all around me was from the previous night's tide, so I retreated higher up the bank. You have to be careful when dealing with tidal forces. In China, 86 people were swept away by a tidal bore on October 3, 1993. Then I waited some more, and then waited even longer. 20 minutes behind schedule, a rumble started downstream. The bore came into view and broke on the opposite bank, forming a continuously breaking wave right across the river. It resembled a big ocean breaker, but instead of the soothing rhythm of waves crashing on the shore one after another, the bore produced the continuous sound of a breaking wave. Right behind the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, the Severn Estuary has the second highest tidal range in the world, as much as 14 metres, 45 feet for spring tides. A map of the River Severn shows its sinuous funnel shape. What the map does not show is that the depth of the river decreases rapidly as you go inland. When the huge tide enters the estuary at the sea, the water is forced up the narrowing channel, which gets shallower and shallower. The excess water can go only one way, upward, thus forming the surge wave. While the first wave is the star of the show, if you rush off too soon, you miss the sound of the whelps, the secondary undulations that follow the bore. Floodwater surges behind the bore for a good 30 minutes after the main wave, the force of which is apparent as it pulls along whole trees and other debris. Large undulations form in the water. These waves break here and there, creating a crashing sound to accompany the gurgling and rumbling of the huge mass of water being moved. An audio mixture of waves on a beach and water running down a municipal drain. In terms of bore heights, the River Severn comes in fifth, with larger ones, like the Pororoca in Brazil, having an even more dramatic sound. The Qiantong River bore was described by the Chinese poet Yuan as 10,000 horses break out of an encirclement, crushing the heavenly drum, while 56 huge legendary turtles turn over, collapsing a snow mountain. In 1888, W. Usborne Moore, a commander in the Royal Navy, described it in a more understated way. On a calm, still night, it can be distinctly heard, when 14 or 15 miles distant, an hour and 20 minutes before arriving. The noise increases very gradually until it passes the observer on the bank of the river with a roar, but little inferior to that of the rapids below Niagara. Hubert Chanson has studied the acoustics of the bore near Mont-Saint-Michel in northern France. The rumble of the main wave is caused by bubbles in the bore roller, along with higher frequencies from the waves crashing onto rocks and bridge piers. Low frequencies between 74 and 131 Hz dominate, equivalent to a low octave on a piano. If a writer needed adjectives to describe the sound of a tidal bore, she could do worse than consult The Cataract of Lodore by the romantic poet Robert Southey. Written in the early 19th century, the poem depicts the Lodore Falls, a waterfall in the English Lake District, using onomatopoeia. Stretching over more than 100 lines, it probably exhausts the lexicon of descriptors for moving water. And whizzing and hissing, and moaning and groaning, and thundering and floundering. But water sound is more than just waterfalls and rare tidal bores. There is immense pleasure to be taken from the quiet and subtle, like a babbling brook. The remarkable thing is that in both a roaring tidal bore and a lazy winding creek, the tiny air bubbles make sound at the frequencies where our hearing works best. The physics seem just right for Southey's romantic poetry. But maybe this is more than coincidence. Perhaps our hearing has evolved specifically to discern the frequencies produced by running water. After all, if our hearing worked in a different frequency range, we would be deaf to water, a substance vital for survival. The frequency of the plink when a drop falls into water can be calculated from the radius of the air bubble formed. There is also a mathematical relationship between size and frequency with frozen water. During our visit to Iceland, my wife and I were on the south coast where the calving Breiðamerkurjökull glacier forms icebergs that float away on the Jökulsárlón lagoon. The haphazardly shaped blocks, looking too blue to be natural, break up and drift out to sea, or become stranded on the volcanic black beaches. Tourists make brief stops here, snapping pictures or taking a boat tour to get close to the ice, before carrying on their journey around the main ring road. We decided to camp by the lagoon. During the night, without the noise of cars and boats, we were serenaded by a tinkling sound. Small chunks of ice on the shoreline gently rocked on the lapping waves, clinking together and making rhythmic music like sleigh bells. The frequency of the sound depended on the size of the icicles, something that Terje Isungset, a Norwegian drummer and composer, demonstrates with his ice xylophone. Many years after my trip to Iceland, at the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester, England, I went to hear what Isungset described as the only instruments you can drink after you finish playing. He is an archetypal Norwegian Viking, tall with rough tousled hair, and plays while wrapped in a parka. The performance was full of atmospheric and ambient sounds, evoking memories of trips to Norway. Like a Scandinavian summer, the concert hall was cold. Even with that precaution, the musical instruments do not last long. Dressed in a large winter coat and gloves, an assistant brings out the ice trumpet or the bars of the xylophone. Once the performance has ended, the attendant quickly wraps the instruments and whisks them away to the freezer. The ice trumpet flares outward dramatically. It is treated at the mouthpiece to prevent Terrier's lips from sticking to the instrument. It has a primitive sound, like a hunting horn, and reminds me of the conch shells I once heard in Madrid. From an acoustic perspective, the material of a wind instrument is not so important if it is hard, as discussed in Chapter 4. Shell, horn, and ice may look very different, but as far as a sound wave traveling in the bore is concerned, they are similarly impervious materials. It is the shape of the outward flaring bore and what the musician does with his lips that are most significant. Scientific measurements have shown that conch shells have exponential flares, like a French horn, creating a distinctive timbre and helping to amplify and project the sound. I imagine the ice trumpet works on the same principle. The xylophone had 5 bars resting on an ice trough, with their various sizes determining the different note frequencies. The bars had been cut from a frozen Norwegian lake with a chainsaw, expertly carved, and then transported all the way to England. In contrast to the trumpet, the material of the xylophone is critical because the ice is actively vibrating. Once the bar is trembling, the air molecules next to the bar pick up the vibration, creating sound waves that move through the air to the listener. The air in the trough also resonates, amplifying the oscillations of the air and making the sound louder. Terrier cannot use just any old ice. He must find ice with the right microscopic structure. As Terrier explains, you can have 100 pieces of ice. They will all sound different. Perhaps 3 will sound fantastic. The microscopic structure of a bar depends on how many impurities there were in the water when it froze, and the conditions under which the ice formed, especially the ambient temperature, which affects the speed of freezing. A slow freezing process is best, because it allows the crystalline structure to form in a regular pattern with fewer flaws, enabling the ice to ring rather than emit a disappointing thud. The ice instrument sounded like a member of the xylophone family, but I could immediately hear that its bars were not made from wood or metal. They clinked like an empty wine bottle being struck with a soft mallet. The pure, clear note suited the material perfectly. But these last two adjectives, pure and clear, might just be evidence of how oral judgments are affected by what we see. What other sound could a transparent bar make, apart from a clear one? Scientists have found that we can reliably discriminate between materials only when those materials have very different physical properties, like wood and metals. Listeners latch on to how long the ringing lasts. The internal friction within a grainy wood is higher than within metal, so the wood stops vibrating sooner. This is why a rosewood xylophone makes a bonk and a metal glockenspiel tends to ring. The clink of the ice xylophone was a long way from the cracking, booming, and zinging heard by the harvesters as they cut into the frozen lake to make Terrier's instruments. Wait quietly by a frozen lake as the sun comes up and the ice might shift and crack, or wait as the sun sets and the ice will start to crackle and sing as it cools. These are sounds of geology in motion, an oralization of forces that shape our planet. Scientists have been measuring the noise from these seismic activities using hydrophones to estimate the thickness of ice sheets in the Arctic. To find out more about the incredible range of natural sounds from ice, the cracks, fizzes, bangs and twangs, I met up with artist Peter Cusack in a noisy cafe in Manchester. A member of the sound intelligentsia, Peter speaks softly and describes what he hears with great precision. Peter told me about the 10 days he had spent recording at Lake Baikal in Siberia. Nicknamed the Pearl of Siberia, the lake holds about 20% of the world's fresh surface water, which is more than in all the North American Great Lakes combined. The thick ice sheet gradually melts in the spring, first by splitting into separate flows. Thin, icicle-shaped pieces break off from the edges of the sheet and drift about on the surrounding water, nudged by wind and waves. Millions of these ice shards jostle, creating what Peter described as a tinkling, shimmering, hissing sound. On the opposite side of the world, at the Ross Sea in Antarctica, sound recordist Chris Watson captured a similar transformation from glacial ice to seawater using hydrophones, either underwater or wedged into glaciers. The Ross Sea is a deep bay of the Southern Ocean, where early Antarctic explorers such as Scott, Shackleton, and Amundsen were based. Chris described huge blocks of ice, some the size of houses, carving from the glacier and landing on the still frozen sea. The carving sound was explosive, like a percussive bang from a pistol. The ice also rubbed and scraped together to create a remarkable squeaking, sounding like 1950s or early 60s electronic music. Above ground, the ice was largely silent and appeared inert, but Chris's hydrophones revealed how mobile it was beneath the surface. Later in the transformation, slush puppy ice produced grinding and crushing noises. One of the most powerful sounds I have heard, because you realize what you are hearing, Chris explained. The Southern Ocean was moving this vast mass of ice, causing it to break up from tens of miles away. Walk on a thickly frozen lake, and thunderous reverberations can ricochet through the ice as it rearranges itself. On thinner ice, throwing rocks onto the surface can create alien chirps. On a winter's day, mountain biking in the Llandegla Forest in northern Wales, not long after hearing the concert of ice music, I came across a frozen reservoir with a thin layer of ice, about 5 centimeters, 2 inches thick. Skimming stones on the surface produced repeated twangs, like a laser gun from a sci-fi movie. The sounds appeared alien because each twang had a quick downward drop in pitch, a glissando that is rarely heard in everyday life. Each time the stone struck the frozen surface, a short-lived vibration traveled through the ice before radiating into the air as a twang. In air, different sound frequencies travel with the same speed, so they all arrive at the same time. But ice is different. The high frequencies move fastest and thus arrive first, followed by the slower, lower frequencies arriving at the end of the glissando. The same effect happens in long wires. When sound designer Ben Burtt was creating effects for the Star Wars films, he based the laser gun on a recording of a hammer hitting a high-tension wire that was holding up an antenna tower. According to Swedish acoustician and skater Gunnar Lundmark, the chirping sound of ice can be used to test the thickness and safety of frozen lakes. As a skate moves across the surface, it creates tiny vibrations in the ice, which create a tone whose dominant frequency depends on the thickness of the frozen layer. You cannot hear the note from your own skate because it squirts out sideways, but you can hear the sound from a friend's skate about 20 meters, 65 feet away. Lundmark did a series of measurements to test this out. My assistant, my little lightweight son, hit the ice with an axe, and I recorded the sound with a microphone and a mini disc at a safe place. He concludes that if the tone was at 440 Hz, in musical terms, the A used by orchestras to tune up, then the ice in most cases is safe. But if the tone is a bit higher in frequency, say 660 Hz, or an E, 5 white notes up on a piano keyboard, then the ice thickness is only about 5 centimeters, 2 inches, and is dangerously thin. To take advantage of the singing ice, however, a skater needs to identify the frequency or equivalent musical note, which is something only people with absolute pitch can do. Unmusical skaters will have to discern ice thickness some other way. With ice, the size of an icicle and the frequency of the noise it creates are inexorably linked. The same is true for air bubbles in water. Is there a similar mathematical relationship between grain size and frequency for singing sand dunes? One would expect so because such a relationship exists for most sound sources. Violins are smaller than double basses. But whether the sand grain size is important to the frequency of the booming dunes has been hotly debated, and thus far the data have been inconclusive. However, recent laboratory tests by Simon Daguerre-Bowie and colleagues at Paris Diderot University in France may have tipped the balance of scientific evidence, showing that grain size dictates the dune's frequency. Daguerre-Bowie took sand from a dune near Al-Ashkara in Oman and showed that when the sand was sieved to select a particular grain size, the boom altered. Before sieving, the grains ranged from 150 to 310 microns in size, producing a hum over a broad frequency range from 90 to 150 hertz. When the sand was sifted to select a narrower range of grains, from 200 to 250 microns, a clear single note at 90 hertz was heard.